Do you ever find a guitar that was in Franco's attic, no?
Which one?
The Yamaha. I had three gears.
Oh, you have a guitar of yours, yeah?
Yeah, yeah. Where is it, in your gaff?
Yeah.
You said to me the action on it is so bad you'd need an arm like a leg to play it.
Yeah, my fucking voice grips. Make great kindling.
Hi folks, and thanks for listening to this Tortoise Shack podcast. That little clip you just heard is a tiny little excerpt from the wonderful Fresh Batch podcast with Damien Dempsey, and it's out right now on patreon.com/tortoiseshack. We're delighted to have Dean and Sparky on board, and we are looking forward to weeks of entertainment and an open and vulnerable conversations, because the lads seem to bring the best out of everybody that they talk to. If you're not already subscribed to The Fresh Batch, you can find it on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you're not already a member of The Tortoise Shack, please join us. It is 2024, the year of elections, and we have lots and lots of work to do to try and cover them in as much depth as we can, but we can't do that without your support. So while you're listening to this podcast, click the link that says patreon.com/tortoiseshack. Join us. It's the price of a fancy cup of coffee or a cheap pint nowadays, and it helps keep the mics on and the conversations like the one you're about to listen to keep happening. We've no ads, we've no sponsors, we rely entirely on you, and it is activism. You cannot say that the Tortoise Shack is just a podcast platform. The work we do goes well beyond that, whether it's fundraising in Gaza, whether it's working with people who are bogus self-employed, or whether it's amplifying stories that need support to get out to a wider listening audience. And there's thousands of you listening, it's crazy. Thousands of listening, very few of you chipping in. I understand that, why pay for it when it's free? But I'd like to think that if you bumped into me in a coffee shop, you'd buy me a cup of coffee. Think of this as the way that you're buying me that cup of coffee. And as I said, for you, it's probably, what, one fewer pint a month. But for us, it's literally lights on, mics on, and we can continue to keep going and throwing as many haymakers as we can. Even if we fight and lose, it's better to have had the fight sometimes. Thanks for listening. Thanks for the support. Patreon.com/tortoiseshack. Please click that link. Enjoy the show.
Hello everyone, and welcome to Palcast, a podcast brought to you by Yusuf El Jamal here in Istanbul, Helena Coben in Washington DC, and Tony Groves in Ireland. We're very delighted to have Palestinian American poet and physician Fadi Jude, who's joining us from Texas, I believe, to talk about poetry and resistance and Gaza and everything in between. Just a kind reminder to our listeners, it's March 5, 2024, and it's 5 p.m. here in Istanbul, and we have a lot of things to talk about today, Fadi. We're very glad to have you on the podcast, especially that you're releasing your poetry collection today. We're very delighted and lucky.
I am honored. I am delighted. And I love the way you much. I love the way you say my last name.
Yes, this is how we say it. And yes. I'm going to talk more about the Judaism that I know maybe later in the episode. But could you please start by telling us about the title of your poetry collection, which is not usual, as far as I know?
Yeah, I have said, you know, that I couldn't imagine words at the title, and I couldn't especially... I mean, words for the title on the book cover, and that I didn't really think of what to call it or how to refer to it until my publisher, as we were speed publishing the book, because it was written during or composed during the first 3 months of the genocide, asked me how to refer to it or what to call it, and I realized that I hadn't entertained the thought, and I still refuse to refer to it in public, and I hope I continue to do with a particular description.
So just for our listeners, I would say, because they can't see what you held up, what it looks like is looks like three dots inside square brackets, which I would I could maybe call it three dots, or I could call it ellipses. But Fadi, you obviously don't want to call it anything.
Yeah, and you know, and some have called it bracketed ellipses, ellipses in brackets, or you know, just describe it as a pictogram. Somebody mentioned it as a some kind of a sign or a code in JavaScript. And I realized that the questions that were coming up were also questions that refer to the way we are all committed to marketability. Because, you know, you have to market something. And so I realized that I was having also a silence about that. I think that, as you know, I have said before, and we chatted a little earlier about this, it is a book that asks people to really consider what kind of listening have they not been offering to the Palestinians, what kind of listening they think they have been offering to the Palestinians, but have not, especially in English. And I also think that it is a book. So it is a book that wants to enforce the question of silence from the recipient at when the Palestinians speak. The Palestinians, it's like someone, a friend of mine, Muna Karim, said, the writer Muna Karim said to me in a text, can the Palestinians speak? An echo of, can the subaltern speak? And I think English is still in denial about English's incapacity to let the Palestinians speak. It has become some kind of a boogeyman for the Palestinians to speak in English. And I also think, so the book is asking with its title for people to listen, to really engage a different process of listening. Number one. Number two, I think that Palestinians are not even afforded their silence. We need to be silent. We need sometimes to resort to silence, to return to it for healing, for restoration, for our own humanity. But what we find out, particularly in a domineering world, that when we perform our silence, we are further erased. We are not listened to in our silence. And I think that it is also a process that the English world has to learn how to be in the presence of a silent Palestinian and listen to Palestinian silence.
So as the token English person on this podcast, which is the position that I always adopt, especially with regard to Tony, who is from the first of the nations that were colonized by the English back in the 16th and 17th centuries, I would love to invite you to read a couple of the poems, Fadi. The ones that I really love from the ones that you sent are one that starts, "You have entered the tunnel," and then the one that is on the back cover of the book, which is so powerful, which is a poem written to our dear mutual friend, Dr. Rifat al-Arir. But, you know, if you are up to reading one of those, and then, you know, we could read the other one later, or we could talk about Rifat. What do you think, Yusuf?
Absolutely. I think we can listen to the reading of the narration of the poem on the back, on maybe like another poem that you prefer.
I can do both.
And kick off the conversation. We have a lot of things to talk about, Rifat, and you know, Palestine and poetry, and how poetry is a means of healing, you know, during genocide. Please go ahead.
Just to say that, you know, when I say English, it's a euphemism for, for a language of hegemony or the lingua franca. And it includes German and French and, you know, and what have you, because they are siblings or half siblings in the same household. And it certainly, you know, you could say, well, they speak English in, in the UAE or in Nigeria, or, you know, and it's not necessarily to kind of have a blanket statement about all Englishes are the same.
Actually, Fadi, on that note, I mean, I've done a lot of research into the history of Western imperialisms, and the languages only became codified with the development of global imperialisms. Like, it doesn't make any sense to have a separate Portuguese or Spanish language, except that you had separate empires and so on.
Yes, thank you. Yes, I would like to say that one of, before I read the short poem for Rifat or in correspondence with Rifat, that it was one of the last, or maybe it was the last poem that I wrote for the book, and I realized that the book was ready when I wrote it. And I didn't want to include it inside the book. I put it on the back cover as a way to even give it its own space to honor Rifat. You know, it was a response in a way of wanting, you know, my little jealousy perhaps to reclaim Rifat's voice through a Palestinian's voice. It is wonderful to see how the world has stood behind Rifat's poem. And I think most people don't know that Rifat's poem was written 10 years before his death, or maybe 9 in 2014. I'm not entirely sure. Maybe Yusuf can correct me on this precisely.
2011.
Even more. And so, you know, it is a poem that was written by someone, by a Palestinian who has already experienced this kind of a chronicle of a death foretold in sort of an you know, Marquez echo, and this kind of you know, better late than never arrival to a Palestinian voice goes back to what I just said about, you know, the proof of the poor listening, if any listening at all, to Palestinians in English. And so I just wanted to correspond with Rifat, who I was with on a WhatsApp thread at the beginning of the genocide, and I was constantly amazed by his presence and energy. There is a kind of a freedom, that a liberation that he embodied in his daily breath, that I think few of us were lucky enough to come in contact with. And, you know, in 2014, I wrote this essay, may not be one of my better essays, but the title is very dear to my heart. In 2014, after a brutal Israeli war on Gaza, a Palestinian poet from Gaza will rise and win the Nobel Prize. Is a little bit of a, you know, it's a little bit of a, there is still a little bit of satire in it, because I was realizing at the time this kind of swelling tide of solidarity or empathy to the Palestinian through the Gaza narrative. And, you know, I think Yusuf and I would love to reach the day when Palestinians are part of the heritage of the world and the consciousness of the world without unspeakable cruelty and tragedy. Suddenly, I, in a blaze, died. Suddenly, time quit lingering. Suddenly, you can't find my body. Can't bury what you can't find. My final poem I wrote years before my hour arrived. Suddenly my voice, thought voiceless because stateless, gave voice to a noisy world. Suddenly a kite. Suddenly I.
Thank you very much, Fadi. This is really, this brings memories, and it just like makes my body shivers. I remember when I first heard that Rifat was stuck under the rubble after being targeted. I felt so sad, but at the same time, I thought maybe this is, you know, the Rifat that we know, he will rise again. And really, like, this is how I felt, that one day I will see Rifat like walking, you know, in front of me, because there is a chance, you know, he's under the rubble. Maybe he will, someone will save Rifat again, and then we will see him. And I had a phone call with Nusaybah, his wife, soon after he was killed. Even his family did not know that he was killed, except after probably 24 hours, because they couldn't see him again. They were sheltering at a school, and they were in fact told by a neighbor that he found the remains of people who were in that apartment that was targeted, and they were torn into pieces, except for one person whose body looked like Rifat. He was very thin, and he said he buried the you know, the remains and the body in a clinic in Hayat Daraj neighborhood in Gaza City. And up until now, his family doesn't know the exact location of his grave. But this neighbor said he will show them the grave soon after the genocide ends. But I see also your poem speaks for over 8,500 Palestinians who are still stuck under the rubble of their homes. And I can't imagine the horror, you know, families go through every night, every day for 5 months now, imagining that they have loved ones, you know, stuck under the rubble, unable to save them or even have, you know, sort of dignified burial for them. This is, you know, redefinition of savagery, as one of our guests earlier said on this show. And I thank you very much for highlighting, you know, this issue of Palestinians still stuck under the rubble of their homes 5 months later.
Yeah, no, I am with you. I think that savagery might be even generous. Yeah, and it is no consolation to know that history will not forget all these stories and details. It is no consolation, but I think the Western world and Israel will never be able to walk away from this, walk it back, erase it, pretend that it didn't happen. Never again, indeed.
Fadi, can I ask a question from a strange perspective, again, coming at it? I don't know if you were ever aware, but there used to be a thing called Section 31 in Ireland, whereby members of Sinn Féin, who at the time were obviously the political face of the Irish Republican Army, the considered the, you know, the terrorist organization when you turned on the BBC and all of these issues where it was being raised about fighting ultimately colonial powers as we have been. But one of the interesting things is Section 31 meant that you couldn't have a member of Sinn Féin on our media. They would actually, they were never broadcast. And if in fact they were going to be broadcast, their voice was dubbed by generally, yes, indeed. So if Gerry Adams had a point to make and they decided they had to cover it, it would have been an actor's voice used. Never, ever, ever. Could we hear Gerry Adams' voice? So Section 31, and it strikes me as something that you keep saying, I'm gonna say it, the white world fails to listen to the Palestinian voice. And, you know, I can just hear echoes of Section 31 that when I turned on the news, I couldn't hear what was happening. Only 90-minute drive up the road from me in Belfast, I couldn't hear what was happening because I wasn't allowed to hear it. And now we see it now. Can you hear those echoes now in that Palestinian voice? Is that, like, when we're talking about Rifat, we're talking about everybody else, is that what's not going to be unheard from now on, hopefully?
I hear in your elucidation and reminder is, for example, how the British became psychotic, really, when it comes to the Irish question. There was this absolute psychotic fixation on the British that they had to suppress and erase the Irish people. Mutilate their identity, their language, etc., as if somehow the survival of the British Empire depended, and it did not depend on that, on the erasure and the mutilation of a people, the masking of their voice, of their language, etc. And obviously this is quite a colonial, in the modern era or in contemporary age that we live in, quite a colonial practice, that Israel has taken on quite well, with a different narrative. And obviously also in the Palestinian, story, Arabic is still held on to, and it's not completely, really in the throes of Hebrew, you know, so to speak, because Palestine still lives in Arabic, in ways, that I may be in trouble for saying this, that, Ireland, less so, because of its engagement, with English. And again, I am sure that I will catch hell for saying this, but I will ask for forgiveness. So I think that, I have said before that I believe that, that in the end, Palestine will survive and will live in Arabic first and foremost, even though I am someone who lives in English and writes in English. I think that English has a long way to go before it even accepts Palestine's existence, period.
Fadi, do you also write in Arabic such amazing poems, or do these poems only come to you in English?
I do write in Arabic. I do not know if they are amazing in Arabic. I'm pretty sure they're not. But what happens with me is that I live between the two languages. And it is a private, human feeling or liberated humane feeling to not be in my privacy, stuck with the supremacy of one language over another. But I don't think that a lot of, recipients, are able to embrace that. There's a lot in this book, for example, that is a conversation or comes out of a conversation of my Arabic reading of classical Arabic literature, whether it's Mutanabbi or Ma'arri or Ibn Arabi and Hallaj, let alone, of course, contemporary writing. And it
or
finds
the Quran. I mean, there are Quranic.
Absolutely. And the idea that, you know, for me, it matters a lot that in my work, I have to transform my relationship to Arabic into a creative imagination, just like Arabic writers do in their own texts. And again, just like Rifat's poem, the famous poem, did by actually, you know, embracing a lyrical sort of a classical English with its rhyme scheme. From someone who lives in Arabic deeply, but is also in love with John Donne and Shakespeare. And you can hear John Donne in that poem.
Absolutely. You know, I know that Rifat wrote a poem in Arabic called Ila Waladi Ahmed, to my son Ahmed, who was born in 2006 when Rifat was doing his MA at UCL. And I've been trying to find this poem. I hope I will find it. But, you know, I want to go back to what you just talked about, Rifat's poem, If I Must Die. And as a Palestinian poet and someone who knew Rifat, and how do you think this masterpiece became this masterpiece? Like, in the sense that what made it very special, other than like lyrics, that it went viral, and today, almost 3 months after Rifat's assassination, the anniversary of his 3 months anniversary is tomorrow, people are still talking about this particular poem.
Yeah. And they will for a long time. I'd like to start by saying, and when you say I knew Rifat, I corresponded with Rifat. I'm very sensitive about claiming bonds with people, you know, even with Mahmoud Darwish, who I talked with a lot, but I'm not going to say I'm his friend or I was his friend or so forth. So, but What I think, obviously, there is a historical moment that elevates Rifat's poem to what it has become, which is obviously a world historical, you know, genocide moment that is probably going to upend international law. And so you have this poem that documents it. And as I said earlier, yet it still comes from the past because he wrote it, you know, more than 10 years ago. There's a power to that. But let me say that, you know, to speak of poetry, poetry at the moment in which it releases us into the afterlife is one of the couple of things perhaps in poetry that makes us so dependent on it as human beings. We search for poems that release us into the afterlife, that create an afterlife out of our life. I don't mean that necessarily in a religious sense. Rifat's poem speaks about a continuation of life while speaking about being liberated from it as a cruelty, as a life worse than death, and still is able to sing life. I think poets historically, in any language, in every language, have always amazed us when they were able to capture our death, which is to say, our renewal. And I remember when I was a child reading, coming across an obituary of the late Egyptian poet Amel Dunqul. And it was one of his final poems, Diddumen. And it's about him being in the hospital. Everything around him was white, the milk, the pills, the doctor coats, and so forth. And it was such a stunning poem that I knew when I read it that I will die a poet, because he was able to capture our entire humanity in the moment of his exiting life as we know it through our consciousness. And so I think,
but you're also sorry to interrupt, you're also the man in the white coat, and I'd love you to talk a little bit about being a physician as well as a poet.
Sure, and I think Rifat's poem does that for us, as Emel Dunkel's poem Diddumen, that it releases us, you know, as you know that death will release you from the conscious life as we know it. It releases you into a renewal, and you know where your life will live on. And I think it's such a longing that we have as human beings to imagine through the poem, through the liberatedness of the poem and of the poet, where we might live on, how we might live on. And even though the answer repeats, it's the same answer in poems. You must live to tell the tale. You know, we can't have enough of it. We want to hear it again and again and again. In brilliant rendering. As a physician, Helena, I understand that I am trained as a person who performs or has to struggle with performing biopolitics and necropolitics in society, which is to say, I am a servant of the state, as the state says to me, how I provide you, the patient, so there's a separation already in the pronoun between me and you, the doctor and the patient, how do I provide you with means to a healthy life? And the state decides that for the physician, irrespective of the independence of scientific findings. And of course, business, you know, enters the mode in the way we live in a capitalist medicine world these days. And in the worst case scenarios, when things get really awful, I, as a physician, also become an agent of necropolitics. So the silence of physicians across the Western world, by and large, for example, and probably across the world, period, is actually an exhibit of the agency in the depths of the Gazan people or the Palestinians, because we're saying that we know you, we will bring you back to life after we accept your death, after we do nothing about your death, not even offer it medicine, not even raise our voices here about it. So I am aware that the modern physician has to struggle with these moments of breaking free from just being an agent of the institution. This is not to say that I am devoid of common decency, compassion, humanity, empathy, etc., or that other physicians or most physicians are. I don't think we are devoid of these things, but I also think these things are not achievements. They're basic things. Common decency should be more common. So it's not an achievement to be human and to, you know, fumble and stumble in the presence of the suffering or the needs or the despair of other people. But I think we underestimate that in our sort of modern or civilizational, between quotes, world, that I, as a physician, perform my task within the administrated confines of a world that tells me who gets to live and who gets to die.
Thank you for that. I keep hearing in you a critique of the capitalist system as well, which I'm kind of, you know, I'm really digging, I have to be honest with you. But putting to one thing that comes out of that is one of the lines you've written that you kindly shared with us in advance of this is that you said, "Hope left me, but it isn't true." I'm constantly brought back to that when I've been preparing for this podcast. Hope left me, but it isn't true. I would interpret it in my way, but I would be very interested to hear you as the person who actually penned it, how what you felt when you wrote those two brief sentences.
Well, in one way, if I'm being fully transparent and honest, it was also a nod to the beautiful soul and art of Vital Adnan. That's one way to begin that conversation. The other thing is to say that hope, like love, is the domain of everyone, and it can go very sour. Hope can make you oppress people in the name of hope. Love can make you kill people in the name of love. And Yusuf, we know the famous proverb in Arabic, "Kum al hubbi ma qatal," some love kills. And so I wanted something. I wanted just this a little turn of phrase to kind of suggest the vulnerability of hope, that hope is probably best when it is more vulnerable and not necessarily some kind of hegemonic power. It's difficult to be romantic about these general concepts, you know, today, about hope and love and light and so forth, and what any of these essences mean. Maybe we have corrupted them in our modern language, but it's what I struggle with as a poet in order to kind of bring these things back to their good nature, so to speak.
Yeah, because we can
actually. I'd love to invite Fadi to read the whole of that poem that starts, "Hope left me, but it isn't true," because it's not, to me, it's not mainly about hope, but, you know, hope is the jumping off point.
Yeah. "Hope left me, but it isn't true. Malady stayed by my side. We grew intimate. Whatever night chased me, I chased it with night. I grew ignorant in love. I grew an ignorant love. From state to state, allies and friends helped me to shrink my malady into a corner. It whined and on occasion accused me of betrayal. It had the right. Sometimes I let it nurse me." I think, Helena, you're right that it was a reference to how hope is the twin of illness. And the question of what that illness is what opens hope onto light or darkness.
This, you know, this reminds me of saying by Mahmoud Darwish that hope is an incurable disease that Palestinians have. And it brings me back to this particular line in Rifat's poem, these two lines, if I must die, and then let it bring hope. And I see a philosophy here. You know, I knew Rifat very well. I traveled with him. I lived with him. He made jokes about me, and Helena knows a lot of jokes. And Rifat was a person of love and joy. And every time I was around him, I laughed and I learned. But the philosophy here is, if I must die, it's like, it's not something that Rifat chose, but then it happened to him. It had to happen to him. He was forced to, you know, to live this life because someone decided to take his life out. As if Rifat, even when he wrote this poem, even when he was dying, he insisted on life. And this is how I see Rifat. And then he wanted his death to bring hope and be a tale. And I cannot think of anything that is more honorable and beautiful than this.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, whether you choose to quote Jesus or Rumi, you know, the idea of, you know, and in my death there is a kind of life, or that you know, you must die first before you live again. You know, we go back to our conversation earlier about this this moment of, you know, final liberation that the poet is able to capture when they become one with the reality of life on earth. As a simple organism of life, you know, the human, we come, we go, we recreate and so forth, you know, just like the birds and the trees.
One last question I have before I give the floor to Tony and Helena. If I'm not mistaken, I think you come from السوافير, right?
لا, من السدود.
السدود. And then we have Judas who come from السوافير too. السوافير الشرقية and الغربية. الشمالية, sorry. There is no غربية. And the north and the east. And I know an old man in Gaza who happened to be your father's friend, Ahmed Al-Hajj. He always told me about Sawafir and, you know, the ancestral village. And I also, you know, I see some posts sometimes by your dad on Facebook talking about his original village. And I wonder if there is any place in the poetry collection where you also speak of, you know, the shared memories of the oral history that your father passed on to you about your ancestral village, Al-Sdoud?
Not in this book. It's an interesting question you ask, because we still go back to this question of Palestinians speaking and listening to Palestinians when they speak and in silence. I have written about these things in previous books, but the process of listening is really slow. Suddenly I now in a genocide. And I also, next year will be publishing a sort of my take on memoir called The Remainder is in Your Life, Al-Baqiyya fi Hayatik, Palestinian stories that will actually engage, some of my parents' memories as children, about this dude and Gaza.
So I had one last question about the composition of the poems in this wonderful book that I'm going to receive my physical copy of tomorrow. Hurrah! So it seems that you wrote them between October 7th and, roughly speaking, December 6th, when the day of Rifat's killing, or soon after, because your poem to Rifat forms the closure of the book in many ways. And of course, the genocide still continues. But I'd love it if you could talk a little about your process of, like, you get up in the morning, you learn about what's happening in Gaza, you have to go to work, your job as a physician, you have your family, and then these like just explosion of amazing compositions comes to you.
Well, you know, I think it's a, I mean, I've been living with being a poet for quite some years. And so in these extraordinary circumstances, it was hard not to just let the whole world in and then let it out through words, you know, the words flow out. But I do say in one of the poems, I wake up to what I go to bed with, without dreams. Nightmares are my days into weeks, into months. So, and you know, this is a saying in Arabic, نصحى اللي بننام عليه. And, you know, you wake up with what you go to bed with. And it was, these were just intense days that still are, but certainly at the beginning seemed endless. And that it was hard to separate myself from what I felt and how others around me felt and the news and back home and everyone here. My parents, they're old people. You know, we were all reliving our entire history of 75 to 100 years in these hours relentlessly. And this is what I try to explain to some people who ask me the question about witness. And I say, I am not a witness. You are. I am enduring a genocide. Or let me just say that if you are a witness and I am a witness, we are totally two different kinds of witnesses. This isn't about me watching horror on TV. This is about me reliving in every particle of my Palestinian identity, what I grew up with, what my parents said, what my grandparents went through, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And this is hard. Again, I go back to the listening in English. This is hard for a lot of people whose hearts are in full solidarity with Palestinians to understand or to listen to patiently and absorb. That we are not some kind of, you know, Yusuf is a more authentic Palestinian or Rifat is than, you know, Fadi or Jamila or, you know, whoever else, depending on where. It is, as I say in the poem in dedication, I'll say this. You know, to those whose memory, imagination, and bodies are my memory, imagination, and body, from the collective to the one under the same assault, no matter our location on earth, our bodies have different ways of knowing, but our bodies know. And so this is a moment that for me is no surprise that I am in full unison with the Palestinian body, just like that. So how could I not go to bed with the poetry I wake up with?
Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant explanation and really, really delighted. Thank you, Yusuf, for organizing this today. I think our listeners are going to get a lot out of it. There was a story, I don't know if anybody picked up on it during the week, whereby there's a play about slavery in the UK at the moment, and they've asked for a couple of evenings for it to be shown where there'd only be people of color, black people, whatever way they want to identify, go to see it because they wanted to experience it without that kind of, for their voices, rather than to do it in front of, even with people who maybe sympathize with that. And it created this awful culture war nonsense, as if, you know, people wanting to have a black only audience was somehow diminishing my rights as a white middle class man. And I think you've just explained that idea of listening and bearing witness and how it's different. You didn't say the word, I felt like you were a participant and not just bearing witness. So thank you so much for that. Yusuf, I'm sorry to do this. I know this sounds terrible, but there was a couple of really cool things happened this week. I don't know if you guys are familiar with Bashar Murad. I'm a big fan of his. He's as a pop star from East Jerusalem, and he came second in the Eurovision to try and qualify for Iceland because they allowed him to enter on the hope that he would win and represent Iceland in the Eurovision. Coming second is no mean feat. I think that's brilliant, and I think it's great. It shows that there are little acts of solidarity and little acts of, again, where we come back to how the art and music can actually unite people. And fair play to the Icelandic community for adopting the song and allowing them to try, because it wouldn't have happened in many other countries, I can tell you. And then We've seen, again, just one other quick headline. There's a lot of fights between Netanyahu and Benny Gantz at the moment. It's like watching a football match and hoping both teams could lose, folks. You're just sitting there wanting, can no one actually win this? So, look, I promise, that's me done now, Yusuf. Over to you. And I'm really blown away by how great this has been. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Tony, for your comments. And thank you, Fadi, for your insights. And Helena, I would just like want to conclude with, you know, this idea of silence and silence during grief. And I always thought that Palestinians, especially Palestinians in Gaza, but also elsewhere in in the world, are not given, you know, the time to grieve in silence. And in many cases, we find journalists and people who want to just, you know, take footage of families of Palestinians killed by Israel. And I thought, you know, these people deserve a break. They don't want to see anyone right now. They want to grieve in silence. And it also brings me to a conversation I had with a Palestinian photographer about our understanding of silence, and his and this is very generic, I know, but it's interesting that he thought silence is the noise between it's the moment between two noises, and that's because he grew up not listening to music and he did not have the chance to appreciate music. So for him, that was his definition of silence. Thank you very much, Fadi, for joining us, and we wish you a very good luck with your new poetry collection. I think it's very interesting, starting from the title that is very difficult to you know, decide on or describe, but this is also part of the creative idea of the poetry collection and the poems you have. And I think this is a very critical historical moment for our people in Gaza, and having this poetry collection will be a witness to, unfortunately, a genocide that unfolded in front of our eyes.
I think if people, listeners, want to look for the book, they need to go to Milkweed Editions, and the poet Fadi Judy, and just look for it however you can, because the title is a little elliptical.
The easiest thing we can do is I'll add a link to the bottom of this, so you'll be able to click on it and find it that way. So
And it's the book that has the colors of the Palestinian flag as on its cuff. You know, you'll recognize it. Yeah. And my name in Arabic. Like, actually, a funny little story. A person in a reading recently asked a friend of mine, what is the title of the book? Because he thought that my name in Arabic was the title, and I said, well, that's another point. to have my name in Arabic on a poetry collection in English.
You would, I'd have made the same mistake, so don't worry about it, whoever that person was.
Thank you again, and I would like to thank our co-sponsors, the Hashim Sani Center for Palestine Studies, and of course to thank Helena Coben of Just Word Educational and Tony Groves of the Echo Chamber podcast for joining me today with Fadi. Thank you, Fadi, and I hope to get my hard copy very soon.
Thank you.
If I must die, you must live to tell my story, to sell my things, buy a piece of cloth and some strings, make it white with a long tail, so that a child somewhere in Gaza will look in heaven in the eye, awaiting his dad, bereft in a blaze.
to his flesh, not even to himself. She's a kite, my kite you made, flying up above. Thanks for a moment.